Hello, everyone. My name is Jacob Minig. I'm the host of the Behavioral Health Integration Podcast. Today, we have a very special guest. Her name is Samantha Knight. She has her undergraduate in addiction counseling from Metro State University. She then went on to Adler Graduate School to get her master's degree in clinical mental health. She is also the owner and CEO of the Breakthrough Wellness Center. Samantha, I'm honored again to have you on my podcast. Thank you so much.
Yes, you're welcome.
So for all of you that don't know, me and Sam are actually former students at Adler Graduate School, and we might get into some of the classroom topics too along the way. But again, I know she's going to provide a lot of great content for me and all the listeners out there. So again, it's an honor having you, Samantha.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. So this is what I love asking all my guests is, you know how we grow up and we all want to be certain things as kids. You know, me, I want to be an NFL player. And obviously that didn't turn out to be. But again, our passions in life change as we get older. Did you always know you wanted to be in the mental health addiction field?
Yes and no. So I didn't know exactly which aspect of the helping field I would get into. But yes, I've always wanted to be a helper. I used to want to be a teacher. I used to, you know, play with my little sisters and pretend to be the teacher. And then it went into me playing as if I was a therapist and having them sit on the couch. So yeah, for me, it was very early on.
Very Freudian style, right? On the couch and free association. Huh? Yep.
Yeah.
I dig it. Okay. So I guess getting older, was there ever like a moment that really got you really passionate, you know, got your fire going?
Yes. So there were a few moments that made me very passionate about the field of counseling. For one, both of my parents, unfortunately, were addicted to crack cocaine. So with that, a lot of childhood adversity, which caused me to have my own mental health diagnoses, which made me really passionate about the field.
As you gain that passion, could you tell me, like, how did you start, I guess, applying to schools, or how did that go about?
Yes. So it's really funny. I actually did not know that you could be an addiction counselor. Yeah. I didn't know that that was like a field. Mm-hmm. Right. So I first went into just straight up psychology. Right. I'm going to go into psychology. I want to be a psychologist. That's what I was thinking. But as I got further into it, I learned that there was different types of counselors. And the addiction one just really stuck out to me just because I was like, oh my God, it had impacted my life so much that I was like, this is where I belong. So then I went to Metro. I got the bachelor's degree in addiction counseling. And then the mental health really came about because I noticed working in the field, the addiction and the mental health, they literally went hand in hand. And so I'm like, okay, in order to be a better addiction counselor, I need to have the mental health piece as well. And so again, that just made me really passionate, not to mention my own experience with mental health, just wanting to know not only how to heal myself, but how to heal others as well.
Now, you being in the minority, do you feel like there's sometimes issues on the way minorities get therapy? Let's say, I'm just going to again throw it out there, you know, Caucasian therapists, because unfortunately, like, the majority of therapists out there are Caucasian. And have you ever experienced any issues with that?
You know, I think the barrier came way before I even got the opportunity to see a therapist. Where I'm from, it's just not talked about. It's not really, if you're struggling in the schools, the teachers were not saying, hey, what about counseling? So it was really something I didn't know about. And once I became older and started to look for my own therapist, I'll be honest, I went to a Caucasian woman. And it was just, we were so different. I did not go back for a second session. I felt like there were things that I was bringing up that she should have had some awareness about without me needing to like explain those things in detail. And so for me, that was a huge barrier. And so I do see a Black therapist, and you know, that's my preference.
Let's say a Caucasian woman or the female therapist, she heard your issues, right? She heard your stories. Did she just try to ignore them or not empathize with you? Is that kind of how issues came about?
Yeah, just really like, okay, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's too bad. Yeah. Okay. No, and again, another topic I do want to get into is how, again, we can help with that issue. And of course, there's two aspects to it. There's the aspect of Caucasian therapists need to learn more about multicultural awareness, and they need to learn how to apply it more efficiently. That's always going to be beneficial. I'm also believing that they're just, in the grand scheme of things, there needs to be more minority therapists out there.
Right.
In my honest opinion, I think that's more beneficial comparing to having white therapists learn more about multicultural awareness, even though they're both very important.
Right. Yep.
And how do you think we go about doing that?
Well, I think a few things. As I said, I wasn't even aware of the type of counseling jobs that were out there or careers. So I think we have to first start in the high schools.
Okay.
And start to prepare the younger people. Hey, this is an option. And I think having more minority in the field is huge because, right, you have to see people that look like you actually doing it for you to believe I can also do it. And so when you see a field that is dominated by a specific race, it makes you feel not empowered to move forward. It makes you feel less than, and that's just reality. It makes you feel like the oddball kind of. You know, even me right now, most places that I work, I'm the minority, right? I'm the only Black therapist, right? And it's okay. That's not a struggle of mine. But I think in order to really bring the minorities into this field, we have to be aware. We have to know that these jobs are available. I just think people have a lack of knowledge that this is even available. And then on top of it, I think when we talk about just even with school, I think the teachers can do a better job of even maybe helping minority students actually complete the degree. A lot of times when minorities get into the internships, right? So they're no longer necessarily in the class, but now they're in the field technically. And they're working in organizations that kind of feed ideas maybe minorities have in their head about how they would be treated. For example, and I'll just share, you know, a story, what I've experienced with being in the field. It was really hard for me to sit back and see the lack of awareness and the lack of like cultural responsiveness to clients.
Okay.
If that makes sense. It was really hard for me to sit back as a minority and just literally see the care that minorities were receiving. And so, again, if we're going to have minorities in the field, I think we really have to have some inclusion. We have to put them in higher positions. Like, am I going to be in LADC for 10 years or will I ever be promoted to program director?
Mm-hmm.
And if not, I'm really just stuck in one position. And, you know, it's really funny, even me personally. Again, I've been in this field for over 10 years and I've always been hired for an LADC, but never for the higher positions. And so, again, I think if we're going to get more minorities in the field, we just have to do a better job of inclusion and making sure they just don't sit at the lowest position.
Yeah, opportunities. And I think it's more of a respect thing too, acknowledging your hard work that can go unnoticed in a lot of people. Like, are we taking the time to look at things differently?
Right.
And unfortunately, I might have been guilty in a lot of situations of just working with minority clients and maybe doing or saying things that I just didn't know I was being offensive.
Right.
And it's funny, it kind of reminds me to one of the classes we took together, multicultural awareness with famous Rashida Fisher. Shout out to Rashida. You're awesome. Love you. Yes, but no. Yeah. And I just remember one day, I think it was that first night too, we were getting into great conversations. And I will say this, the one thing I really loved about our class is that it wasn't, yes, there were more like Caucasian students, whatever, but I really felt like we actually had a good amount of minority students in the class.
Yep.
And I, for one, extremely benefited from it.
Right.
And I just remember, like it was yesterday, she had told me, she's like, you need to admit that the last two generations, at least your family, so your dad and grandfather, had white privilege.
Okay.
Right. And I never disagreed with her, like, in that moment, but I was like, oh, she's telling me. But again, I didn't take it as, like, disrespectful, but it's true.
Right.
It really is true, and I just feel like in aspects, like, Caucasian people in general are not always aware of that.
Right.
And if they do try to gain awareness, you know, it's kind of like my dad, when I kind of tell him about that stuff, we get angry. We get upset because when we hear things like that, we take it as like we're lazy or not hardworking. And that's not the point at all.
Okay. Right. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And I guess for me, I never even thought of it from that perspective, but that makes a lot of sense. And I, you know, thinking back, I do remember you kind of saying something of the sort like that in class. It was a pretty intense class for sure. And these conversations, they are intense, right? But I think they're so necessary. We have to get through them. We have to talk about these things because, again, just going back to your original question, how do we get more minorities into the field? These conversations as well, right? I've worked in so many organizations where these conversations were happening on maybe a yearly basis because DHS required this training. But I don't think the organizations are doing a good enough job to make sure, hey, let's do these trainings at least once a month or at least every 3 months just to make sure we are all culturally being responsive and aware. That's not only on Caucasians, that's on minorities as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, just going back, how do we get more minorities into the field? Again, I think conversations and I think really pushing them into the field. Again, if we don't start at the high schools, but letting children know, hey, you can do this, have counselors speak at the high schools. I've actually been reaching out to a lot of high schools to do some of that myself. And just flat out say it to kids. Hey, we need more Black therapists. Right. Absolutely. Like the community can use you. So if you have a passion to help, or if your family has been impacted by certain traumas, or if you have your own mental health, this is maybe a field to consider.
No, like we need to let them know you are special. You are important. You can benefit not just your race, but this world and this country and everything. If you decide to be in this honorable field, you know, you are special. You're important.
Right.
And again, there's just so valuable to humanity and healing humanity, again, from those traumas and all other issues, you know. Right. And it's about honoring and putting the work. Like you said, you know, people do the DHS training, what, once a month maybe, or not even that?
Oh, no. It's probably maybe once a year.
What are we saying? What are we saying as a community or as a country or however about that? Oh, we got to do it, but it's just more of an issue than anything. So let's just get out of the way.
Right.
Does it need to be that way?
Let's do the bare minimum so we can keep up with DHS standards.
And I feel change will never happen that way.
Right. We need to go above and beyond. Absolutely. For real change to happen, we have to go above and beyond.
It was funny. I was talking to minority friends, and she's a social worker. And me and her, again, getting really into these deep conversations. So going back to Rashida in that class is just like, I'm more comfortable talking about stuff like this.
Right.
Now, whereas before, I wasn't. Right. And I had an epiphany, whatever, like a deeper epiphany than like the white privilege thing, where my minority friend was just like, well, Jake, it's even names. Names are just powerful. Parents will choose not to give their kids certain names because of how they're going to be judged.
Right.
And at first I was like, what are you talking about? Okay, Jake. She's like, let's say a job person calls you whatever and asks you your name or sees a name on an application and it's a minority sounding name. You're probably not, there's a good chance you're not getting that job.
Right.
Because of ignorance. And I'd never ever thought about that before. I never thought even a name could have so much power.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Name, hair, right? We know that the hair has power. There's a lot of different things. And that's why I say, if we're going to bring minorities to this field, I think they have to be welcomed. Again, I think we have to prepare them in the high schools because there's a different generation coming up. So my hope is that more minorities do get into the field.
Amen. Now, I also want to ask you like another question too, and go with like the miracle question. Even Black, white, Hispanic therapists, there's barriers in this field. And if you could take your wand and just wave it around, what's like one negative thing you would get rid of if you could in the therapy field for it to grow better?
Yes. I don't know if this could ever happen, but if I had a magic wand,
yeah,
I would really want programs to just be more culturally responsive and culturally aware. And I say that because, again, how I've seen clients be treated, I can't say it's out of evilness. I can't say it's necessarily because people are purposely trying to be harsh. So let's say, for instance, if from a completely different culture from you, right? Mm-hmm. I eat different, I talk different, I process things different, right? It's going to be really hard for me to kind of come into your world and really make that connection unless I go into your world and actually know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say, for instance, somebody who, I'm just going to use North Minneapolis right now, because we know a lot of minorities. We also know there's been a lot of violence, just a lot going on in that area, or just in minority field areas in general. Like, I can't believe some of the things I've heard my coworkers say.
Okay.
And it just shows just how out of touch they are with the minority cultures. And so I think they have to do a better job. I don't necessarily know if you can read a book or attend a seminar and really understand what a culture experiences on a day-to-day basis, unless you are in their environment. And so we know that that's definitely not happening. And so if I had a magic wand, it would be way more in-depth on-hands cultural training.
Okay. Do you mind telling the listeners some of the things your coworkers might have said, or like not the exact same thing, but the genre of what they said that was maybe taken as ignorance?
Yes. You know what? I'll give you a really good example from kind of what you just said. I'll use the name thing that actually happened at one of the places I was working at. So every time we would have, a minority client with a name that was, a little bit harder to pronounce, we would be in like clinical meetings and it would be like a joke almost. And they would all like say a different name, like Jacquesia. Or they would just say, well, let's just call her Jay. And, one day I actually stood up in the meeting and I said, people's names are their identity and they mean a lot to people for you to actually try and say their name correctly. And so they kind of were just surprised and they were like, oh, they didn't say too much, but they heard me and that was kind of it. But it was really hard for me to continue to sit back and actually see the staff kind of joking about it like it had no importance. Because I went through a similar story. So my actual legal name is not Sam. It is Samiko. I go by Sam because I was so tired of people that I was working with just making up names for me or just not trying to pronounce it right. And so it just got to the point I was like, hey, just call me Sam. And so that's a real thing. And so those are some of the issues. I just can't believe in 2020, right? That was last year when that comment was made by the coworker, that we're still in a place where we don't know how important names are in different cultures.
We're almost blind to it.
And for me, that's really surprising because there's so many books, there's so many movies out there that kind of teach you the history of a name, right? Like sometimes your name can mean warrior. It can mean the first son. It's so many different meanings for names. I just get frustrated sometimes, I'll be honest.
And please, so, yes, please be honest.
Yeah, I really, really, really get frustrated, which is honestly that is how the birth of Breakthrough came about.
Mm-hmm.
Just due to my frustrations, me taking it a step further and saying, hey, let me create a program where minorities can have a safe space to get better.
And that safety is so powerful too.
Because
what is safe for a lot of people may not be safe for others.
Right. Absolutely.
And God, as people too, we take safety for granted. And again, it's seeing the life through another. In episode number 2, I kind of got into this.
Okay.
Regarding my internship experience. And
okay.
I won't get into all the details. I'll keep it, you know, short and sweet. But, you know, I was working at a Latino charter school. Again, I won't say the name or anything.
Okay.
And my supervisor is Latino, and she's LMFT.
Okay.
And we had definitely a powerful moment. It wasn't good.
Okay.
And it was I don't know if it was my lack of awareness in the moment and situation, but what I said to her was, I was applying for a job.
Okay.
It was like a homeless outreach position.
Okay.
So the job would be working late nights, and I'd be going to people advocating for the homeless shelter. Hey, do you know where these homeless shelters are? This and that, this and that. And I don't know if it's disrespect on my part or ignorance, but my initial thought was, I'm not going to lie, like, okay, well, North Minneapolis, that's where the job was. It was in a lot of different locations in Minneapolis, but this particular one was North Minneapolis.
Okay.
And I'm not going to lie, I thought danger. Like, okay, I this is dangerous. And in the grand scheme of things, I don't think I'd be comfortable walking up to anybody and advocating for homeless shelters. But I have to be honest, I heard, okay, North Minneapolis, nope. And I don't know if it was a mistake, but I let my supervisor know that. Well, she wasn't too happy. She wasn't really saying I was being like racist or anything like that, but she was implying that I was being ignorant when I said, like, you know, I just fear for my safety. I don't know North Minneapolis very well. I've been there maybe just a handful of times, and I don't want to do the job. And she kind of had a negative effect to it. How I was just being ignorant in the sense that she lived in North Minneapolis, by the way. So I think she took extra offense to the fact that I said the neighborhood was dangerous. And I don't know. I took it as her telling me that I'm a bad person for saying that. Like, I fear for my safety for North Minneapolis. So again, I'd love to hear your like awareness on that part, because.
No, you know, in that situation, I think you were valid. North Minneapolis is a dangerous, it's dangerous. That's a real thing. So I don't necessarily know if I would call that ignorant, because the reality is there is a lot of dangerous activities happening in that area. And I've actually, I maybe have been over there once. So I really can't speak to the area other than honestly what I'm seeing on the news. You know, I have people who are from that area and they tell me, yes, it's very dangerous. You know, they've been involved in shootings that they had nothing to do with. And so, no, I think you were completely valid. I think you're right. If she lived in that area, she probably did take offense, right? That's just like if somebody said your area was dangerous, you would kind of be like, hey, what are you trying to say, right?
Right.
And so I can understand why she did take offense to that. But no, I wouldn't say that was necessarily ignorance as far as, because it doesn't sound like you were saying, I don't want to work with those kind of people.
Correct.
It was just more, I want to make sure when I'm walking to my car, I'm right, safe, right? Like,
yes.
I'm a white guy in North Minneapolis,
well,
right?
And there are some white people who do live in North Minneapolis,
yes,
too. Oh, God, I tell you what, like, the biggest thing that got me pissed off is that she said if I was in a room full of Black people, whatever, and if I said what I just said now, they'd all hate me. And I was just like, what? You're a minority. I understand it's like you're a minority and everything, but you're not African-American. You're not. So please don't speak for African Americans. I have African American coworkers who tell me North Minneapolis is dangerous. And I kind of let that get to me more than it should have, but I don't know. I must have internalized it some way, because I feel like my concerns for myself and my well-being weren't being validated.
Right.
And do you feel like all minorities experience the same type of issues, barriers?
Yes and no. I think just the fact that we are all labeled as minority, that in itself is just similar. And this is just, I'll speak for, I guess, Black people, because I'm Black. I think we are the most, like, I've seen, you know, Spanish people, I've seen other minorities treat us as if we are, you know, the worst thing on earth, right? And so I think that's different. I think we are a group, for whatever reason, we have just been portrayed as just like evil and lazy or just uncaring individuals. And so I think that's the only difference. That's the main difference, is just out of all of the minority groups, I feel like we are kind of targeted, even within minority groups.
Okay. And do you feel a lot of that is like movies, the radio, the culture that is brainwashing everyone into believing that?
Absolutely. I think the media is responsible for 99% of the issues.
Okay. Yeah, God, that's another problem too.
The media is just...
The media, God, my God, the news. I hate the news. I've always kind of hated it because it's always just been super depressing.
And it's not the truth, right? A lot of times they're just giving you snippets of a situation. Mm-hmm. So you're never really getting the full story. And so I think it just leaves a lot of room for like assumptions or, right? We all have different perceptions. And so depending on the way a media outlet can spin a story is the impact that it will have on the audience. And they're good at their job.
Well, more impact means more money, right?
Right. And that's what I'm saying. And they're good at what they do. So,
So I want to get to a happier note. Was there, again, I know you got your LADC first, right?
Yep.
And how long did you work as an LADC before you decided to go to grad school?
Probably 6 years, maybe.
Okay.
5 or 6 years.
And was there a particular reason that wanted you to go to grad school? Was it more just like knowledge and awareness, mental health, trauma, et cetera?
Yes, it was more of just the knowledge. I wanted to be able to have the knowledge. So I just felt like I was always running into the mental health side. And I was just like, oh, I'm not a mental health therapist. I can't speak to that. Mm. And so it just felt very just kind of restricted as a counselor, right? I want to be able to help you in all different areas. And so that's why I went back to school. And I was like,
"Yeah." You know, I have another great question for you. Since we graduated pretty close to the same time and we're both LADCs right now, I'm just going to be honest and just say, I don't know. I just feel like majority of the treatment centers that are out there are still pro addiction counseling, addiction, 12 steps, AA, NA, and I feel like sometimes I struggle sharpening my mental health tools.
Okay.
When I'm just stuck working as an LADC. Do you have any similar experiences to that? Or do you see any of that?
Absolutely. Which is why right now I'm doing strictly mental health counseling and I contract with somebody with that. So that's separate from Breakthrough. But I do that to separate the two. Okay. Because like you said, if you're doing LADC work, it's almost like it merges. And since my first hat is from an addiction standpoint, I'll never get out of that if I'm not strictly dealing with mental health. Because the difference is, too, a lot of my mental health clients don't have the CD part. And so I'm dealing strictly with mental health. So, absolutely. I think it's going to be really hard to gain a knowledge of both without... You know, I think it's good to bring them together, but I think you have to do them individually, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to be honest, too. Like, I still think there's a lot of bias between the two.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, there's so many changes that I feel like need to happen in the field. If I had my magic wand, I'm going to go back to that. Actually, what I would do is...
I'll give you another wish. How about that?
Thank you. I think we really just... The whole field just needs to be revamped almost. I think we've been doing the same thing for so long and we're not seeing the results. And so it's like, how much longer are we going to go with these same practices, these same ideas before we say this is not working?
I like using this analogy, and I just created it a couple of days ago, but I thought it was pretty cool. It's like you have the addiction side as one kid, and you have the mental health side as one kid, and they're bickering and fighting, and the parents. And I won't be like the parents, like, knock it off. Get along and knock it off.
Right.
This has been going on for way too long. Yes. And God, it's rooted in, through my experiences, I don't know, ego, frustration, yes. Lack of awareness,
yes.
Stubbornness.
Yes, people been in the field 20 plus years and they're really yep. not wanting to think, you know, they're like, I'm not, and I think it's more of, right, you go through a lot of school, so it might just be, I'm not ready to relearn something, right? That's going to take more effort. Again, we're doing this bare minimum.
Yes. Amen. Amen. And, you know, and I've ran into LPCCs who also are like, oh, well, mental health is more important and they need to focus on this and that and blah, blah, blah. I mean, I can't tell you how many times as an LDC, I try to get a hold of a licensed therapist regarding our client, you know, good coordination of care. And again, I struggle to get a hold of that LPCC or they make it seem like it's I'm a nuisance or a nuisance to try to like, hey, communicate you, this help with our client. And yes. And by all means, I'm not talking crap about LPCCs. I hope to be one very soon or soon someday.
Right. No, but I think what you're saying, it's a real thing. And again, it goes back to the bare minimum. What do we learn in school? We learn that the coordination is very important. And so what I've noticed the same things, you know, this is my first year as a mental health therapist and people are almost amazed that I reach out to them.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm, you know, like my clients, other providers, and I'm like, well, I thought that's what we're supposed to be doing. And so it's just, I think there's a lot of change that needs to happen. I mean, a big part of this too, insurance companies, they don't make the situation any better with the amount of paper and the amount of, you know, what they're asking therapists to do. I honestly think therapists are really burned out. I feel like they don't necessarily have the time. And again, there's a lot of different pieces to this. And I'm just hoping that somebody is with some power will wake up and say, we need some serious change.
It's a corrupt system. Can I just say that?
Yeah.
And I'll say, let me make a strong statement right now, right here in this episode. The DHS LPCC, as we know, that's $4,000, right? $4,000 to get licensed. That is bullshit. That, in my honest and respectful opinion, that's a money grabbing system. All they want is more money. It is bullshit. You're making us get 4,000 hours just to be licensed. Now, I love supervision. I get it. I love my LPCC supervisor. Shout out to Martha. You're awesome. Great. Yeah. But I've gotten a lot from her. Do not get me wrong. It's an awesome experience. It's important.
Right.
Make it 2,000. You know, 1,000 hours, you know, your LPC, 2,000 LPCC. Go along with your career, you know?
Yes. I think a big part of that is they charge for the sessions too.
Mm-hmm.
So like you said, it's very money driven because you have to charge for the individual, the group. And not only that, you know, I've actually had a really rough experience when I first came into it. So a lot of these positions, they're contract positions.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no protection for me as a supervisee as far as I'm at this person's demise almost because I need the hours. And so you can kind of pay me how you want to. You can kind of really do where I'm at your demise. Like I really don't have a lot of, right? I can say screw the hours that you gave me, but then I'm out of those hours. So I think it's very, like you said, financially driven. Even the fees that we have to pay to keep our license.
Yep.
I mean, we're helping people. And, you know, I just renewed my LADC and that was a $300 fee.
Ooh.
And I was, you know, it was in a moment where I was like, whoa, this is kind of a lot for me right now. And so just imagine when I'm fully licensed and I have the LPCC and the LADC, I'm going to have to keep both of those. And so you're right. I think we are underpaid. And so to make us come out of our pocket for, like I said, a license, I think you pay that initial fee. You should not have to pay this fee every 2 or 3 years.
Amen. Amen.
And so that's frustrating for me. And, you know, I'm really happy. I really like your transparency. I think it, like you said, is a very corrupt field. And I don't think anybody really has the nerve to say it. I think, right, we're in Minnesota, so we have...
Sure, I hope DHS is listening to me right now. I hope they are listening to me right now. Say it. Jacob Minnick said that is bullshit.
Yes.
It's just, maybe I could have sounded more clinical when I said that, but I'm sorry. No, Enough's enough. Like,
I love it. I love it. And, you know, that's so funny because I was like, once I finish my master's degree, I can kind of speak to these things and not be afraid. Like I said, I think a lot of people are afraid to like challenge DHS or challenge the field. But one thing about me, I've always been a little challenger. So I'm not going to sit back and just.
I remember.
Right. I'm not going to sit back and act like things are okay because I don't have to. I don't allow anything or anybody to hold that much power over me. If me speaking the truth about the field is going to get my license taken away, I don't need the license.
Amen.
So that's just where I'm at with it. I hope somebody from DHS does hear this because it's very corrupt. And like I said, there's no protection for me as like a supervisee. I went through some pretty traumatic situation when I first got into the field. And so I lost out on those hours. Basically was told I was an incompetent counselor, even though I was not being supervised and I had been with them for 8 weeks. So that's 8 weeks of me being brand new and not being supervised. Mm-hmm. But then the blame was kind of on me and it was like, wait, where's the accountability for you? And so that's when I really realized, wow, the licensing board really has to do a better job of making sure that we are protected.
You know, and I'm glad you said that too, because that's another passion of mine why I developed this podcast, because it's not just for us right now in the field. It's to make a better life for the future therapists that are coming up.
Right.
So they don't have to put up with this crap.
Right.
I swear that all that is holy right now. It's like, let's say I do my 4,000 hours, get licensed and whatever. If I could change the way things are done so the future therapists of this world are coming up who... Let's say I only have to do 1,000 hours or 1,500 to get LPCCs. That would make me so happy.
Right.
And I don't even care. It's no ego thing like, oh, I did 4,000. They got to do. No, that's bullshit.
Right. And, you know, that's funny because I've actually had someone say that to me in the field. Well, that's what I had to do as an intern. I actually had a supervisor tell me I was kind of challenging just how I was being paid, how I was being supervised. And, you know, she told me that's kind of the ropes. She worked for a company who barely paid her. She basically worked day and night for no pay. And this is kind of how this works. And so I kind of told her, you know, that's great, but I don't think I have to go through the same exact struggle as you. And so I think you're right. Like you said, it's not about ego. We did it, so they have to do it as well. No, you should want the next generation to have it easier.
Because again, let me ask you something. Like, if this keeps up, are we going to have a lot of therapists down the road?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
What are we doing when we say things like that?
I think we are making people, well, it made me just feel like, is this really worth it?
It's funny. It's like I ask myself that same question sometimes, where it's just like, all right, even as techs too. Techs, counselors, I love techs. They are the lifeblood of any facility. Yes. Shout out to techs.
Yes.
It's like, okay, we're asking you as human beings, go to this facility, go to this job, work with a difficult population. Yes, it's loving, it's care, it's rewarding, it's great, but we're asking you to go in a very stressful, sometimes traumatic environment to help these people. You have a constantly rough days at work, and we're going to give you a very low wage. See you again tomorrow. See, a person on the outside just may look at that and be like, why would you do that? Or what, you know what I mean? There's no logical sense to that, you know?
Especially in today's world. I'm sorry. We know that you need money to survive in America. And mm-hmm. So for me, I think the money has to be talked about. I think it's another conversation people want to stay away from, right? It's the miracle question. You don't ask people what they're making, or you don't ever talk about your salary. And again, it's a conversation we need to have, because at the end of the day, and I've explained this to my supervisor, I cannot, like you said, come to work, deal with people's problems, and do that in my right mind if I can't even pay my rent. It does not work. I'm stressed out. And so I just really feel like we are definitely underpaid. You know, I see some mental health positions, $17 an hour. And I'm honestly baffled. And I'll just say this right on the air. I would never accept a position at that price. I would never.
As a tech, like 5 years ago, I was making, I started out as a tech making $9.75 an hour.
Okay.
And I eventually got to like $13 an hour. But that's still horrendous. It's like you're working with, again, in my case, it was like teenagers with like mental health and addiction issues, and they give you that wage. And it just grinds my gears when people say, especially supervisors, I literally had a supervisor say, yeah, you know, it's a stressful job, you know, being a tech and everything. I get it. But what's your skill? Like, what's your actual skill level? That much. And again, it's a power thing too, because could I tell that supervisor what I really felt?
Right.
No, or else I'd get in trouble or whatever. But,
right.
But in the back of my mind, I'm like, what the hell are you thinking?
Right.
And that almost tells me you were never a tech at a treatment center. Because if you were a tech at a treatment center and you were worth your damn salt, you would never say that.
Right. Absolutely.
Well, your skill level, you're not very skilled.
Wow. Yeah.
You just take emotional abuse every day from clients. But I don't know. Right.
That doesn't take a skill, apparently.
God.
Yeah, so I think we really have to, especially now that I have my own business, I know what the actual organization is getting. And so I think there's a lot of power in greed, right? I think that's in most fields, unfortunately. But I just think in the mental health field and the addiction field, it just doesn't, we don't have room for it here. We are supposed to set the bar high. At least that's my perception. We are supposed to be the leaders. We are supposed to be the pillars in the community. We are supposed to, you know, show what integrity looks like, show what appreciation it shows, you know, how to value each other. Mm-hmm. And I just don't see that happening in the field. And it, for me, I'll honestly say, if I knew what I knew now, I don't know if I would have pursued this career. But now, you know, $160,000 later of school debt,
yep.
I'm not going to say I'm stuck in the field, because again, I don't let anything hold power over me, but I've definitely had to think of strategic ways for me to stay in the field and feed my family.
That's just horrendous that you actually have to do that. With the master's degree from a great university, we look at ourselves and like, this doesn't make sense.
It does not. It's just like teachers. I feel like teachers are really undervalued, underpaid. I think they should be one of the highest paid positions. They teach children all day. They teach the next generation, and look at what they're paid. And so it's really, I don't know, for some reason, it's how the world works. You can be an Instagram model and make millions a year.
Oh God, TikTok. But,
you know, you're helping kids and you're barely getting by. And so it's just, I don't know. I think the whole culture just needs a shift. I don't know when that's going to happen, but I'm hopeful. I am hopeful. I'm hopeful that, you know, people are waking up and seeing that we got to do things differently.
Opening their eyes. And I'll tell you, like, one of the things that really grinds my gears, and I talked about this last episode, don't you just hate it when other mental health professionals walk up to you or LADCs are like, oh, hey, you know, we're not in it for the money. So that pisses me off so much.
That's terrible. I mean, that was, so many instructors said that to me during school. So I think every instructor possibly said that to me.
And I feel like
you're not going to make $1 million in this field. And okay, not necessarily wanting to make $1 million, but again, I need to be able to pay all of my bills and do what I need to do so I can go to work and be ready for the world. Because when you're working with this population, you're dealing with everything.
Mm-hmm.
From trauma to people just not even knowing how to be in their own skin to, I mean, seeing people die. You know, I've been in the field for so long. I've seen so many people commit suicide, you know, not actually seeing this, but, you know, getting the email the next day, hey, you know, JW committed suicide last night. Yeah. Or we all know with the opiate crisis, the amount of overdoses, you know. So it's a lot. I mean, it's a lot. And I think we really have to be compensated for that.
And my challenge to the system and to those people who say things like that, why not? Why can't we make a good salary, a good amount of money, and take care of our clients?
Right. Absolutely.
Why don't we not deserve that?
Absolutely. Yep. And unfortunately, I think it's going to take people like me and you to not be quiet anymore and to really speak and to get other people to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And get behind us before change will come. I think there's a lot of great instructors. There's a lot of great people in the community, but I think they're really afraid to speak up.
I agree. But again, I know you do and I do. We want to be that voice for change.
Absolutely. That's my motivation, honestly, now to, you know, in the field, is to be the voice of change. It's not my idea to just, you know, for the next 10 years, come into my office and see clients and go home. No, I want to make impact. I want to make change.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And now I would like to take another turn in the interview. What a lot of my listeners want to know and what I want to know is, one, that's awesome that you started your own business and company. Again, Breakthrough Wellness Center. How did that happen? One, like, where did you get the idea and how do you do it?
Yes.
What are the steps?
Yes, yes. So the idea, it came really early on, actually. So I'll never forget, I walked out of my first LADC class. And, you know, I was feeling really good. Not my first LADC class, my first internship.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, man, how awesome would it be to create my own program with my ideas, you know, running the groups, what I see fit. I just felt like it would be very empowering. So, but I was so early in it. I was like, nobody will take me serious. You know, I'm at that time only an ADCT. I'm still working on my degree. So I put that on the back burner. I got my bachelor's degree and I knew for people to take me serious, I would for sure have to be master's level. I think that's one of the requirements, actually. You have to have a master's. And so last year, it was my last year at Adler. And I was like, this is it. This is time. It's time for the birth of whatever organization. And it was really funny. The name Breakthrough came about because that's what I want to see. I want to see clients kind of like breakthrough. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that's how the name came about. And I know a really good woman. She helps people. She does consultations. So that's what she does. She helps people start their own programs. So I reached out to her. I sat down with her and she walked me through it step by step. This is what you need to do. This is what you can expect. And so I did it. And I became licensed last year, 245G license program. We're going into our second year. January will be open for 2 years. It's been really, thank you. It's been slow. It's been a challenge. I opened up in the middle of a pandemic. So the first year we really didn't do much at all. This year we are marketing. We're really trying to get clients. Breakthrough Wellness Center, it serves adolescents. That is, you know, we also service adults. We are culturally specific, so we specifically are for minority clients. Not to say, you know, if you're Caucasian, you can't come to Breakthrough. Mm-hmm. No, but we do specialize in historical trauma, things of that nature, cultural responsiveness. And, you know, what's funny about that is I don't get a lot of referrals.
Okay.
So I found that to be another frustration because we are in a space where everyone is saying we need more culturally specific programs. And it's like, do we? Because I'm marketing to probation officers. I'm marketing to other programs. I'm marketing to DPS. I'm marketing to people in the community, and I'm not getting referrals. So if anybody is out there listening and you have a say-so in this, I would just like to know, where is the disconnect?
Right. Like, is there another motivation why they're saying that? Is it to look a certain way, but not actually, talk is cheap, walk the walk, maybe?
Yep. Jacob, you're a smart man.
I mean, I just call it how I see it. You know, like they sound really good when they say that. Yeah. Where's the walking?
You are spot on. And so that has been so frustrating for me.
I can imagine.
So frustrating. I'm like, you know, I've put so much into this business to help people. And so it's, you know, I'm not going to give up. I'm very, very dedicated to Breakthrough Wellness Center becoming a go-to program. I'm very want to get into statistics and keeping, you know, just the surveys for my program and really, really listening to the clients. What do you guys want to see different in the field, right? Because at the end of the day, that's who this is about, right? We say we're so client-centered and things of that nature. And I think we have to do a better job of even listening to the clients. Mm-hmm. You know, I've worked in a lot of programs where clients are sitting in group for 6 to 8 hours a day. Doesn't work. I don't believe in that. I don't think that is effective in any way. I don't think it prepares you for when you get out of treatment. Mm-hmm. I think it's a culture shock for you to sit somewhere for 90 days and not have seen the outside world. And then all of a sudden you're just back home. And so I think we have to do a better job of really providing long-term care. You know, so many times you can go through a 30-day inpatient program and again, you're out. These people are not following up with you. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people, they walk out of our doors, no driver's license, no birth certificate, no identification. I mean, these are the basic things you need in life.
It's horrible that, again, yeah, I see it all the time too, where you're not preparing them. So again, what are you saying? Oh, please come back to us because there's a good chance you might not make it.
Yes.
And there's controversial opinion,
a good chance we will have a bed waiting for you.
Yeah. Let's just call it how we see it. Yep.
And so that's so frustrating. It's, and you know, I hate to say it, but I feel like we've got to a place where we are profiting off of someone's illness. And not the, you know, yes, we're here to, like you said, make money, make a decent living, but there reaches a point where this is just pure profit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a client once, and I'll say this. He was in our program and he couldn't read or write. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I go to my supervisor and I say, hey, this client's here for a while. Why don't we add this to their treatment plan? You know, they have apps that can teach you how to read nowadays. I'm just like, are we just going to sit here and have him in group and he's really not even understanding what's going on? And so, you know, my supervisor just kind of said that wasn't a priority.
What is?
And so I was just so confused. I was like, wait, so I couldn't understand.
What does help look like? What is help that they say they're doing? And what is actual help that's beneficial for the client?
Absolutely. I think we're saying that we are helping people recover. We are rebuilding lives. We are restoring hope, right? These are some of the taglines I've seen different treatment centers have. But the reality comes down to this. If you are an inpatient facility and you do not use some of that money to create housing, if you do not use some of that money and put that back into the community, I just don't understand how are we really helping people? Because as you know, you work in the field, clients come to us with everything from housing issues to family issues to a lack of mental health, period, right? Not even knowing where to get a therapist from, not even knowing how to get their prescription and actually take it to the pharmacy, right? These people are really, 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 I'm not going to use the word sick, but they have a lot of barriers, and I feel like we're only attacking a few of those barriers.
I agree. I mean, I've had clients with severe schizophrenia, bipolar, who are classified as vulnerable adults. Yet when their treatment's over, you can either send them to our sober house or another aftercare program. And I'm just saying to myself, he needs more than that. He will not
Absolutely.
make it in a sober house. Even if there's like other clients there, maybe helping him out, you're leaving him for dead.
Absolutely.
He can't take his meds. And on time, he doesn't know how to get a bus or understand the maps to get to certain locations from. And again, that's where like other services come in handy. Sure, like an hours worker, case manager.
Yep. And I think again, I've been in this field, so I can speak to this. And this is just the truth. I don't care who wants to admit this or not. A lot of times, we're not getting case managers for these clients. We are, again, bare minimum. We are doing exactly what DHS says we need to do to move this client out. What do you have to do? Meet with them once a week, right? Make sure they have a treatment plan. Make sure you review this treatment plan. Outside of that, DHS doesn't require much.
Maybe update every once in a while, the treatment plan and
Yes, I'm sorry. If your program has made millions of dollars last year, some of that money should go back into the recovery community. Whether it's you building houses and making affordable housing for clients, whether it's you making sure, maybe your place has a spot for moms can where moms can come in and get like food. There has to be something else. There's no way a program should be making millions of dollars and not putting that money back into the community.
No excuse for that.
Absolutely no excuse. And I'm just really surprised that nobody is speaking of, I just can't believe how long we've been doing this. We have been doing this for since probably before me and you were even born. This has been. And so it's just really sad, but I think we are in a space now. I think there's a lot of Jacobs, there's a lot of Sam's coming into the field. And so I don't think people are going to be quiet for much longer.
And again, I want to help develop those little Sams and little Jacobs. And so they could speak honestly, openly about this field and not go through the struggles that I mean you've gone through.
Absolutely.
It's, I swear to God, like, I'm going through this process and like you had so many dreams. And I'm not saying those dreams are dead, but
Right.
it's like when you get out of grad school, you have certain expectations of what your career is going to look like. And I feel like with mine, yours, passion and everything, that we have like rockets on our feet, right? We're ready to explode. We're ready to make an impact. My friend Goose and everything, he said something very special to me one time where he's like, if you're making a change, you're getting into a field, don't just walk up to the door open, knock that freaking door down,
Right.
knock
Absolutely.
it down.
Absolutely.
And I, me, you, I'm sure we've all been wanting to do that, but it's like having rockets on our feet ready to explode and then being in concrete. It's like, oh, you're just the rocket's still going. You don't know how to get there,
Yes. And so I think some things like this, right? Having the podcast, right? I think these things are going to open up doors. Like I said, I think it's going to get awareness out. And what I'm really hoping is that clients and their families start to speak up and say, hey, this is, you know, a lot of these programs, they're either getting some type of county funding. And so the county, again, they're responsible for a lot of this.
Yep.
You have the power. All you have to do is say you're going to not give them funding, and I guarantee they revamp their program.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, I think this is on the county. This is on DHS. This is the licensing boards, the lawmakers, the people in the substance, you know, the substance abuse subdivision. Those people have a lot of power, and they can make changes. And again, mm-hmm. I think people are really afraid of change, and we know that's a mm-hmm. real thing. And so,
or what's going to happen to me when I speak out? Oh, the politic game. You know,
am I going to lose my job? Am I going to, right? And we know that mm-hmm. those things are real. People have lost their jobs for speaking up. Yep. So, I think
that's fear. That's fear,
right? And so, I don't have any fear when it comes to that. And so,
I think that's DHS's fear.
Absolutely. You can
lose your license. Waves.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You can lose your license. That's another thing, right? Like, there's so many things we can do to lose our license. And so, again, it's very fear-based, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, you have to have boundaries, but sometimes I think this, you know, may be a little bit too tight. Again, I don't know if it's client-centered.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah.
Well, you need some creativity for recovery, you know. You need some space, and you got to line up that grip.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So that's why when I seen you had a podcast, I was like, hey, man, I've been wanting to really speak out. Like, let me just reach out. Let me
get off. I'm so happy that you did, because I'm, yeah.
Yeah. So, yes, Breakthrough Wellness Center. I don't know if you got the opportunity to check out my website, but
mm-hmm.
for anybody who's listening that is at btwellnesscenter.com, you can go on there. You can check out our website. It'll show you how to make a referral. And yeah, this is the beginning of Breakthrough.
This is right here. And I want to be part of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, again, Samantha, thank you so much for being on my podcast. It is truly an honor and pleasure. And all listeners, again, if you want to get a hold of Samantha, she's great. She has a lot of knowledge and awareness on this field and multicultural awareness issues. She's great to learn with and just all around great person.
Yes, thanks for having me.
I just want to say thank you, everyone. And just to inform everyone, the information and content that was said on this episode today is not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice or interventions. If you find yourself struggling with any type of addiction or mental health issues, please seek the care of a professional mental health therapist or a licensed medical doctor. All right, everyone, thank you and have a good day.